This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with scientists, geologists, and emergency personnel about a huge disaster that is on its way to the Pacific Northwest. And now, we go inside the Compass. Imagine standing on a sandy beach near Port Townsend when, suddenly, the entire ocean rises 40 feet higher and comes racing toward you at 30 miles an hour. Not just a wave, but the entire ocean. That is a tsunami, sometimes called a tidal wave. It has nothing to do with tides. It will be triggered by a massive earthquake on the Cascadia subduction zone. According to seismologists and other scientists who came to Chimicum recently, this is not a hypothetical scenario. It will happen. The only question is when. If you are standing on the beach when it happens, you will not survive. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, estimates that 13,000 people will lose their lives in this catastrophic event throughout the Pacific Northwest. And there's nothing anyone can do to stop it. The scientists who spoke at the event in Chimicum came not to scare us, but to raise awareness about the earthquake and tsunami threat we all face here. They spoke about the risks, our alert and warning systems, and emergency preparedness. KPTZ interviewed several of the experts at the tsunami awareness event. We begin with seismologist and tsunami warning science officer Paul Huang, who was the first man in the world to measure the deadly 2011 Japan earthquake at 9.0 on the Richter scale. His English isn't perfect, but his words are important.
When the New Yorker magazine ran a story the summer before last with the headline, quote, "An earthquake will destroy a sizable portion of the coastal Northwest. The question is when." After that, we experienced sort of a mini hysteria here in the Pacific Northwest. Was that a helpful result in the sense of being a wake-up call to people around here?
Yes, I think it is, because the danger in this area is underestimated by most people. We are going to have a very large earthquake. We just don't know when. The danger is pretty high.
You feel that the people around here are underestimating the danger that actually is facing us, potentially?
Yes, I think everybody thinks about the tsunami. The biggest concern is not just tsunami, but earthquake. Earthquake can do a lot of damage, probably do more damage than tsunami.
It's been a year and a half since that New Yorker magazine article came out. Are you concerned at all about a Chicken Little effect, in the sense that people around here aren't so worried about it now because nothing has happened in the last couple of years?
Yes. For this area, I would say preparation is the most important thing. But we just don't know when. Could be tomorrow, could be another 100 years. We just don't know when. We just have to wait. And more prepared, the better.
The New Yorker scenario describes ground turning to liquid, a tsunami that is completely unsurvivable. That's a quote they had, completely unsurvivable. An electric blackout everywhere west of the Cascades, 13,000 deaths and an impact on 7 million people. How accurate do you think that is of what might actually happen in this sort of Cascadia event?
Well, Cascadia event will be very large if it's happened like we think it is. It might even be bigger than the one in Japan. Yeah. So Cascadia could be bigger. We're not as well prepared as Japanese are, so we may have a lot of damage.
You make an interesting point, because I know Japan has a lot of earthquakes. People are used to them. They prepare for them all the time. I grew up in Southern California on the San Andreas Fault. Mm-hmm. We had earthquakes regularly. We never saw the big one while I was down there. It hasn't happened yet. But up here, I've been here 10 years. I haven't felt an earthquake once. So maybe we have a false sense of security, do you think?
Yes, I think that's true, because Cascadia, unlike other major fault area, very quiet. That doesn't mean it's not dangerous. There are big events here, but just when?
Given the level of predicted catastrophe, is there anything the average citizen can do to mitigate this in any significant way?
Well, I think the preparation is not just the individual level. It could be the county or state level. For example, I was driving, and this first time I was on the coast of Washington, I saw many places there's not enough high grounds to evacuate.
We spoke next with Lynn Sturbins, director of the Jefferson County Department of Emergency Management.
When seismologists say we have a 33% chance of having a massive earthquake within the next 50 years, lots of folks in Jefferson County, where the average age is 55, are probably thinking they don't really have anything to worry about. What would you say to people who are taking that attitude because they're thinking, 50 years, it might not happen for 50 years. I don't have to do anything.
Well, I would say that that is only an estimate, and that means it could happen tomorrow or it could happen in 100 years. That's the estimated average. So we just never know. Science can't predict exactly when it will happen. So why not be prepared in case it could happen tomorrow?
And what you're doing here tonight is to help people get prepared, yes?
Absolutely, absolutely. To become prepared and to have more knowledge and facts behind it. I'm happy to see these panel of experts coming so they can answer more in-depth questions about the science behind all of these hazards that we face here in Jefferson County.
Are you considering or implementing any systems or procedures that might improve our emergency preparedness as a community? And I ask that question because you're sort of new to the job.
Oh, every day I'm implementing all sorts of new initiatives, new marketing campaigns, new public education campaigns, new plans. There's a lot of great things that were already in place here in Jefferson County, and a great community, very invested and very interested in this topic, which is fantastic, very refreshing. But there's still more we can do. And there's been a lot of ask, a lot of demand for additional public education and information and outreach. So I'm very happy to be providing that. It's one of my favorite parts of the job.
I was about to ask you if you could give us a hint or a clue on things that you would like to do that look like are going to happen. Is the education part of it one of those?
Yes, absolutely. So a couple of other things that are coming up in the next 6 months, we're going to be doing a specialized emergency preparedness training for elderly, medically fragile, disabled community, the vulnerable populations, as well as a workshop for the caregivers and providers. There's a lot of new requirements and federal and state laws that require healthcare organizations to work with their emergency management jurisdiction and to have plans in place, and we want to help them do that.
Did you learn anything from the 2014 Oso landslide event that will help you if or when we experience a major disaster here in Jefferson County?
Yes, I learned a lot of different things. One of the things that I think is another area that I'll be working on and improving in our EOC is how to handle logistics, how to handle resource requests. So we are looking at our existing plans, our existing structure and organization, and reviewing it, assessing it, practicing it the way it is right now so that I can assess it, and making some changes to see how it can be more efficient and more successful. Resource ordering and resource management, it's a really, really complicated and often fails in a chaotic activation. So I want to make sure that we can do whatever we can to learn the lessons from the Snohomish County's experience when they activated for the Oso landslide.
That was the first time you had dealt with a disaster of that magnitude, right?
Yes, of that magnitude, absolutely. Their EOC was activated for 39 days, and that was fairly long for what we usually encounter here in the Pacific Northwest. You know, we have a lot of storms and short activations that are maybe just 2-4 days, but that was the longest one we've seen in a really long time.
When the big one happens on the Cascadia subduction zone, what do you think our major challenges will be here in Jefferson County?
Primarily lack of food and water, to be honest. The distributors that provide the shipments to grocery stores are on a just-in-time basis, so they come every day. That we see them on the highways, we see them stocking the grocery stores every day, because they don't have a way, stores don't do that anymore. They don't store 3 days or a week's worth of groceries in the back like they used to. So what we have is what we have, and we aren't going to get any more. I think that's going to be one of our biggest struggles, and that's why it's so important that people take it really seriously, that I want them to store their own food and water at home. That is really critical. And you aren't going to have time to go to the store in a mad rush, because all the other people who didn't prepare will be doing that as well. And possibly the store won't even be standing.
Exactly.
Two of our three grocery stores in Port Townsend are in the tsunami inundation zone. So there you go. That quickly diminishes our supplies that are here.
The model that they're outlining for the big one on the subduction zone is dramatic and catastrophic. So if that actually happens, the kind of scenario that was spelled out in that New Yorker magazine piece, if you saw it, how long might they be without food? How much food would it be prudent for them to store?
In this community, in this county, we have the potential to be cut off because of our reliance on the Hood Canal Bridge and the ferry system and a lot of bridges that connect our highways. So we could be an island. We could have lots of micro islands. There are lots of areas in, like, for example, Discovery Bay or parts of Port Townsend, even with the lagoons, where the water might come so high as to isolate the higher ground from the next higher ground. So there will be micro islands.
Wow.
And that's really an important thing to consider when you talk about preparing and storing enough at home. Your best scenario for most of our residential homes are going to be safe enough to stay in. What we're going to see the most collapse will be our unreinforced brick masonry buildings downtown in Port Townsend. But homes are generally a higher code than some of those older buildings downtown. And so sheltering in place will be probably the best case for most of our folks here. And so that's even more important for them to have alternate sources of heat and plenty of food and water to stay in their home for a month if necessary. It could be a long time before the roads are cleared, the water recedes, and water's going to bring a lot of debris. It's going to bring in all the damaged docks and boats and buildings and all the stuff that comes with that. So it's going to take a long time to clear that, even to make it passable. Even if the road is still under there and existing after the earthquake, it will be covered in debris.
So 1 month is sort of your ballpark figure of how much you should have in terms of food and water.
Yes, exactly.
Because that water might be cut off. Electricity certainly might be out everywhere.
Exactly. So I recommend 30 days.
I was going to ask you what those days and weeks would look like after the big one hits. Is it going to be apocalyptic, like zombies running around, people with guns trying to steal food from everybody else? I don't know if anyone can predict, but what do you think Jefferson County will look like in the days and weeks after the big earthquake and then the tsunami?
Well, imagining it, and that is the worst case scenario, those catastrophic scenarios, imagining it that way, it would be devastating. There will be a lot of people who don't survive. There will be a lot of water, and a lot of debris, a lot of garbage. It will not be a clean scenario at all. It will be messy and unsanitary, and people will be injured and maybe not able to get adequate medical assistance. And so you combine that with an unsanitary situation, it makes a lot of potential problems. So I also envision just a lot of despair, but I also envision in this particular community a lot of great people coming forth. There's a huge amount of resiliency already here because of how bonded this small community is and all of the relationships that already exist here. People are fantastic out here in this county. I've been very, very impressed at the resiliency. And so I think that there will be a tremendous amount of people helping other people. So I know that we are going to have lots of ad hoc shelters and feeding and sharing of the valuable limited resources. I just can see that in the way that this community is. So I know that we're going to be okay.
Some people may think, well, I'll just get in my car and I'll drive to California. Might not be that easy, right?
No, it won't be that easy. Under that catastrophic scenario, it's not just us that's going to be affected. It will be the whole coast of Washington, Oregon, and California, very likely. And so, no, you're not going to get very far. Imagine what I-5 in the Seattle area is like on any given day during the commute.
Exactly.
And then what about when there's a big snowstorm? You know, there's 8-mile, 10-mile backups. People are coming to work 2 hours late. That's normal every day here. Imagine what it will be like when you can't move up and down some of those main artery transportation routes. It's not going to be pretty.
Among those lecturers at the tsunami awareness event in Chimicum was Maximilian Dixon, who manages the earthquake, tsunami, and volcano programs for the state of Washington. We asked him about a danger you might not have even considered.
We're hearing lots of talk about earthquake and tsunami predictions, but what are the chances that we might experience a catastrophic volcano eruption in the near future in this area?
Well, considering the fact that we have 5 of the highest risk volcanoes in the country, in Washington State, we've got Mount Baker, Glacier, Rainier, Adams, and Helens. And that we have a pretty good percentage of, in our lifetimes, having an eruption of some sort. But the thing is about that, we cannot predict what type of eruption it's going to be. We just don't understand the science enough yet. We don't have enough monitoring stations to really kind of tell, and we haven't seen enough in our lifetimes to be able to record the data, to be able to really have a grasp on what type of eruption or how big or what types of, you know, impacts are going to be until things start happening.
Do volcanoes tend to warn you by sputtering, or like did Mount St. Helens give a clue that something was going to happen?
Yeah, there's a few ways that you get some indicators that something might happen. So one of them is earthquakes. So having a clustering of earthquakes where magma is actually moving up through the crust and forming a dome or moving some way up from the bottom or from the middle of the earth. Oftentimes you get a cluster of earthquakes, and then that will give you some sort of sign that that activity is happening. Another way is when you have the release of certain gases. So they measure the release of different types of gases through the volcano, and that will give them indicators on kind of what's happening below the earth. And then the other monitoring that they do is for deformation. So if you have, say, a movement and like a bubbling or sort of a bulging, I would say, of the mountain, that is a really good indicator. There's a lot of pressure happening and something is going to happen eventually. Yeah, so those are kind of the three indicators that they use for warning signs and trying to figure out, you know, is there going to be volcanic activity? How bad might it be? And just kind of a time frame.
You mentioned several volcanoes in our area that are, I guess, still considered active. Are any of them of more concern than another in terms of potential?
Mount Rainier has the highest population density closest to the mountain. So obviously that's our largest concern, just simply because of that, and also because of the mud flow, the Lahar that came off of Mount Rainier and went all the way down to Tacoma. You know, obviously that is a big threat. So Lahars, they move at a really fast pace, and they're like a wall of concrete. So we have some Lahar warning systems in the town of Ording, and I think we have 29 sirens in Pierce County. So we're trying to expand that. We're also trying to, I think Pierce County and USGS is trying to add more seismic monitors so that we can have a better idea of when a Lahar might be triggered. We can also warn people in a more effective manner. So yeah, I would say Mount Rainier, just simply because of population.
You used a word I'm not familiar with, Lahar. What is that exactly?
Yeah, so a Lahar is when you have on the side of a volcano the melting of water or the rapid melting of water, either from hot magma or gases coming up through the crust, or you have some sort of combination of saturated soil that reaches the capacity where it can no longer hold itself, and then it comes down the side of the mountain and it moves probably, you know, 20, 30, you know, miles an hour, or if not faster. And they can be just literally walls of mud that are, you know, 20 to 40 feet high.
What would a worst-case scenario volcano eruption look like from Mount Rainier, especially with all those people in that general vicinity?
You know, it's really hard to say what a worst case would be, because we honestly have not witnessed nor recorded a worst case that I'm aware of. And obviously, Mount St. Helens was a very tragic incident, and we had a lot of loss of life. In a way, we really didn't know that there was going to be that loss of life, because we didn't understand at that particular time that a volcano could blow out sideways. We just didn't understand that that was the threat that we were facing. And so we learned a lot from that eruption. You know, in a sense, a lateral explosion or eruption is a really bad thing. But I would say a Lahar in the middle of the night, that's a really bad case. As far as ash goes, depending on where the wind's blowing, it's not going to be that much of a problem, especially on the western side of Washington.
We're talking about preparedness here, and there are things that people can do to prepare for an earthquake to some degree, and even for a tsunami. How about a volcano? Is there anything you can do to protect yourself or get prepared for the event of an eruption?
Well, the good thing about an eruption or a volcanic event is that you usually have some warning time. So a week, maybe a month, maybe several months. That's the good thing, where we can usually have time to warn people to be able to evacuate them. Now, whether we can actually convince everyone to evacuate, that's a whole different story. But at least we can warn everyone, and we can do our best. So we have some time to do that. For protective actions, I would say that just, you know, when you get an alert, so always have your NOAA weather radios handy, pay attention to the news. And when we alert you and say, hey, this is a danger, and we pick, you know, figure out the air danger area and you fall within that, and we're giving you your local emergency managers or whomever is in charge is giving you this information to be able to evacuate so that we can make sure that you're safe, please just listen. You know, follow that advice. Be prepared to do that. And also, for ash, I would say, you know, if it's a really bad situation, you know, learn about how to shelter in place to keep ash out of your house. Also, you know, there's a lot of great, you know, just wearing N95 masks to protect your lungs, being able to learn how to properly put them on. So we call PPE, personal protective equipment. So just learn how to put those on and be aware of the quality, air quality. And also, I would say just be mindful when you're on the mountains and you're like camping or hiking. Just, you know, pay attention and listen to the park rangers, authorities, so that if they're going to warn you, then you can evacuate. If you live in an area that's at risk of lahars, know your evacuation routes. Know how to get out as quickly as possible. Don't try to drive because the roads are going to be blocked. Practice them as well so that you can get out as quickly as possible, and make sure that you pay attention and have you're signed up for all of your alerting and warning, all the alerting and warning systems. That's going to be able to inform you when, in as quickly as possible, when you need to get out. So definitely practice and get signed up for those. So I would definitely do that.
Do volcanic and seismic events sometimes occur at the same time, with one triggering the other? Could we experience an apocalyptic trio of earthquake, volcano eruption, and tsunami all together in one giant event?
There have been a lot of cases throughout history where a volcanic eruption triggered landslides, and also with the landslides and or the collapse of the volcano have created massive tsunamis. Yeah. And in a lot of cases, earthquakes will be occurring either before the eruption or during the eruption. So you kind of have that trio effect. I want to say that some of the largest, and I mean the highest waves, tsunami waves, have been from landslides that were triggered up to 1,700 feet in Alaska.
Oh, my God.
Yes, higher than the Empire State Building.
Was that the 64
quake? Not the 64 quake. I think it was 59 in LaToya.
Meteorologist Ted Beener coordinates warnings and advisories for the National Weather Service in Seattle. We asked him about the relative accuracy of emergency warnings. We recently had a prediction for the storm of the century, which led to people clearing out store shelves of bottled water, flashlights, canned food, etc. The storm turned out to be sort of a nothing burger, thankfully. As someone who helps coordinate warnings for weather events, do you always err on the side of caution?
Well, in this particular case, I think a lot of misinformation was out there. On Thursday morning, so we're talking 2 days before the storm, we indicated a 1 in 3 chance of the storm center to come inland through the Puget Sound area and really kick our tail. There was a 2 of 3 chance that it would rain offshore and not create such havoc here in the Puget Sound area. And that's what happened with this particular storm. But, of course, in the world of social media and even in our very competitive commercial media, they grabbed hold of that 1 in 3 and they ran with it. Even Professor Cliff Mass at the University of Washington, who was also talking about that same week was the anniversary of the 1962 Columbus Day storm, which was the strongest non-tropical windstorm ever to hit the lower 48 in American history. Those two kind of combined to create that worst-case scenario, which obviously didn't turn out.
Right. Tell me a little bit about the 1962 storm, because I wasn't around. How bad was that? How far-reaching and what sort of damage was there?
Well, again, that was the strongest non-tropical windstorm ever to hit the lower 48. It was a former typhoon, Frida, and it became extratropical in the western Pacific, crossed rapidly across the central Pacific and off the Pacific Northwest coast. And as it turned sharply off of Cape Mendocino, Northern California, and literally was within 50 nautical miles of the coastline, it intensified dramatically. So, in a nutshell, that storm produced winds along the Washington and Oregon coast in excess of 150 miles an hour. In the interior of western Oregon and Washington, from Eugene to Vancouver, BC, in excess of 100 miles per hour. That storm killed 46 people, injured hundreds more, destroyed thousands of buildings, knocked out electric power from the San Francisco Bay Area all the way into southern British Columbia. And finally, and most impressively, it blew down 15 billion board feet of timber from the coast to western Montana.
Unbelievable.
And that's enough lumber to build a million homes. And the power in many places did not come back on for several weeks. They had to bring in crews from all over the nation and even western Canada to come in and recover from that particular event. I myself was a youngster, a six-year-old in the Portland area, living in the West Hills. And so I remember that storm. It's what drove me into this profession. And on my street alone, I had 160 trees down, no power for 10 days. And what was really impressive about that storm is that the power went out or the weather instruments were destroyed early in the storm. So we really don't know what the strongest winds were. And that was true from Northern California as it swept northward along the Oregon and Washington coast. That was the case throughout.
What can or should agencies do to strike the right balance between creating hysteria and simply being ignored when they try to prepare citizens for the dangers of earthquakes and tsunamis?
Well, you know, there's a tendency these days, particularly with social media and blogs, there's a lot more weather sources than we had even 10 years ago. So you have a lot of what I call armchair meteorologists who really don't have that background, but they have an opinion. And that's fine. That's great. But if you want the voice of reason, because sometimes the media, particularly television, tend to hype things.
Yep.
And we saw that with that mid-October wind event is a good example of that. Social media did the same thing. But if you want the voice of reason, come to the National Weather Service webpage or listen to your NOAA weather radio station here in this area, which is literally just above Port Townsend on Miller Peak here, just outside of Discovery Bay. And that is going to give you the information direct from the National Weather Service without the hype. You're going to get the straight skinny. Now, are we 100% correct? Obviously not. But it's going to give you that sensible information and not have the hype associated with it.
Do the forecast and warning system that the National Weather Service uses coordinate in any way with the systems that will be used for earthquakes and tsunamis?
Well, the short answer is yes. That is clearly the case. In the case of tsunamis, they also have warnings, watches, advisories. Just like you have for flood or wind or tornado or snow, whatever the case may be, there are also warnings, watches, advisories. And it all depends on the particular warning level as well as the lead time. For instance, a flood or weather watch, and that's true for tsunami watches, is issued farther in advance to give the community an opportunity to get ready, get prepared. There's still no certainty that that event is going to occur. But the point is to really be leaning forward in case it does go to a warning. At that point, warning is the action state. Take that precaution to help save lives and property. And that's our primary mission. It's protecting lives and property through flood and weather watches, warnings, and advisories, as well as keeping our economy going. As you well know, during lowland snow events, kind of drags the economy down.
Yes.
If we have a major windstorm with a lot of downed trees and power lines, kind of drags the economy down. So that's what we're trying to do here is to stay out in front of it and mitigate the issues as much as possible so we can help protect lives and property.
Speaking with the scientists and emergency personnel at the Tsunami Awareness Roadshow in Chimicum, this is David Cunningham for KPTZ News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by David Cunningham. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio.